Welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Oral History Project, where we record the oral histories of current and former DOC employees. I'm DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. Our guest today, September 9th, 2019, is Bernie Vineski. Thank you for joining us, Bernie.
Thank you.
Before we begin, could you please provide us with a brief overview of your DOC career?
Yes, I started at SAI Camp Hill in January of 1985. I was employed there into 1990, whereas I took a transfer after the incident, the riots there. I went to SCI Frackville and finished my career. After 20 years, I retired as a lieutenant.
Okay, thank you. All right, Bernie, so tell me where you were around 2:30, 3 p.m. on Wednesday, October 25th, 1989.
Sure. I was the sergeant on E and F blocks. They had one sergeant for two blocks. That was something new that they were experimenting with at the time. I actually was on F block, and I remember vividly because there was a new reception that just came over. I remember the younger inmate who was in for a second DUI, and he got some serious state time because he ended up wrecking into the wife of a judge, so they slapped him with some hard time. But I moved him in. He was kind of scared, and he said to me, "Sarge, what kind of place is this?" And I said, "You got a lot of your time in the county. You don't really have that much time left." And he said, "Just keep your nose clean, watch who you deal with, and you'll be okay. You'll be out of here in a couple months." And about 45 minutes later is when the riots broke out. So I actually had gotten done moving this inmate in. I was back in a little closet that doubled as a sergeant's office where extra browns and toiletries for the inmate, and went back to finish up some paperwork. And I had a inmate worker out sweeping up the day room for nighttime blockout. And the inmate said something about, "Hey, Sarge, someone just got hit out there." So I'm actually standing at the window of the F block day room with an inmate. And I saw some other inmates running, so I looked at the inmate. I told him to go back to the cell and lock up. I then went out to my officers on the block, who were Randy Wright and actually Tab Bickle.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them what was going on. And they said they got an order over the radio to secure the front doors. So I looked at both officers and I said, "What we're going to do is stick together, do the downstairs and the upstairs, go pull doors, I'll man the front, and just make sure everything's secure in the block." And I said, "Don't leave each other's side." I no sooner said that than Unit 16, which was Bernie Bubba Baker, came on the radio and said, "16, all units, open your doors and get your inmate in." So I remember looking at Tab and Randy and saying, let me find out what's going on. Get these inmates in. Don't push hours. Just get them locked up. We figure out what's going on." I stepped outside the cell block, took my hat, stepped outside, got about probably 20 feet. I got moved, someone just came in.
Mm-hmm.
About 20 feet from the door, and all hell broke loose. And I turned, and Tab Bickle was holding the door open, and he yelled at me, he said, "Sarge, come on." And there was already probably a dozen or so inmates between me and him. I ordered him to lock the door. I said, I remember telling him, "I'll find another way out." And he closed the door. I turned. I don't really remember this happening. I was told by the officer in the tower later on that I was jumped by three inmates. I remember getting knocked down from behind. And when I looked up, I saw one of our trainees had been hit and dropped to a knee by an inmate. As he turned to get away, the inmate followed around him a second time, and the trainee fell unconscious. For the love of me, I can't remember his name.
Uh-huh.
But I got up and I scrambled over to him. I remember looking down, and his head was in a pool of blood. I shook him. I had no response. He was out. I literally took him up by the shirt collar and then by the by his belt. And I stood up, and I started running with him down the hill towards E Gate, because being a little bit higher up by F Block,
mm-hmm.
I could see that the inmates were working their way behind the officers that cut them off from getting out. As I was going down, the officer actually came to, and he's trying to run with me, and he's like, sorry, I can't see, just hold on to me, I can run. So I took him by the arm, and I got down, and I yelled to everyone, I said, let's get the F out of here. And we scrambled through the gatehouse, secured the smaller gate, and tried to make a stand. A couple of blocks got caught. I know E Block got caught with their front door open. Somehow, I'm not sure how, inmates had gotten into the kitchen area, and there was a remodeling project going on, and key and tool control wasn't what it was years later. And there was lock boxes in there with tools. Inmates came out with some of these tools, and several times they charged at the gate, and we literally were trying to, they were throwing boards at us and all, from broken benches off cell blocks, and we're using them to try and push them back, keep them from breaking through. And inmate took a pry bar, 6-foot pry bar, shoved it through the fence, and just missed my chest. I turned, and he just missed my chest, and he pulled it back through, and when he pulled it back through, he put it up over his head, and there was a single chain holding the double gate together, and he rammed it down through the chain, and several of us at the same time, when we realized he was going to bust the chain, there was no way to stop him. I mean, we were outnumbered, like, 9 or 10 officers to 400 some inmates, roughly, that we guesstimated was coming back from yard. And a couple of us at the same time yelled, let's get out of here. And we turned and started to sprint towards main control. To this day, I firmly believe the only reason we didn't get tracked down or run down by those inmates, some were coming after us, but there was also a group that figured this was going to be a long haul event, and they cut towards the commissary, and there was like a jumble at the gate there of inmates, two groups wanting to go different directions.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of gave us a few seconds delay to get a few extra feet between us. We made it in main control, secured the doors behind us. I remember a good friend of mine, Thomas James, he was a counselor when I ran Mod 6, real good friend of mine. We saw each other, we gave each other a big hug, and asked if each other were okay. And then order came out. We were given some extra riot batons that were stored at in the rear of main control. We went up through group one side to the dispensary, and there was a stairwell that went down into the visiting room.
Mm-hmm.
So we went down to the visiting room, and we set up a sort of like a skirmish line, and then we evacuated main control and everyone that we could out through the visiting room gatehouse outside the fence. We got them out, and now this is already, because we made a stand, this is already probably, I'd be lying if I tried to tell you a time frame of how long it was till we got outside, but there was already a bus from State Police Academy showing up with some of the state policemen.
Uh-huh.
And we went into the armory, we went out back, there was another area that had riot gear, and we suited up and we re-entered the jail with the state police. We came in through the rear gate, and we went through the mods first, secured all the mods, evacuated all the inmates out, put them out onto the ball field, worked our way across, and basically pushed back everything and secure everything up until the original gatehouse where the incident started at.
Okay. E-gate.
At that time, they brought out some hostages, and then that's when the negotiations started. I went kind of blank there for a while. I mean, we were going full tilt. Mm-hmm. And next thing I know, I was in the triage area being treated, and eventually, after a little while there, being taken to Holy Spirit Hospital.
What was your injury?
I think it was just exhaustion. They told me I had tachycardia, which was a racing heartbeat or whatever. I did have an injury to my lower back. They assumed that I got hit with something when I was jumped up in the main compound when the incident first took off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was just part of my friends going balls to the wall for that period of time to get everything secure and everything. And like I said, I sort of remember someone helping me. I can't even tell, the officer helped me or something like that. And then I know I was on triage area. And I think I more or less came when they stuck the needle in to give me an IV is when it sort of woke me up more, realized what was going on.
Wow.
How
long were you in the hospital?
I was actually cleared that night, and I went home. I stayed at the hospital because they were bringing more in, and actually I got to meet up with Tad Bickle, who was my officer, to check with him. He was one that they brought over to Holy Spirit, and we chatted for a few minutes, and I got a message to his fiance that he was okay. He was being checked out. I went back to the jail. They gave me a quick debriefing, and they told me to take a couple days off, let them know how I was doing. And the next evening, I was actually here at the fire company. People were talking to me. We were working on the engine. People were asking me different things and all. And our bartender upstairs came down. He was actually a cousin of mine, an older gentleman, and he said Linda just called, that they called Chris, who was a friend of mine, who was married to a girl I graduated with. They just called Chris back in. The riot started again. I looked at everyone and I said, I don't know. I said, I gotta be there. And I went home, grabbed my things, and drove back down from Shamokin back down to Camp Hill.
Wow.
And then I spent the next well, the next length of time, like 36 hours on the perimeter, and then I was able to go in after the state police entered and that kind of stuff, and they had everything secure. I went in and do escort duty for a while. So after that, after I got home, took a day or two off, I called back to, it was Lieutenant, Lieutenant Garrett. And he said, well, we're doing 12-hour shifts. You're going to be on 12 at, or 6 at night till 6 in the morning. I said, okay, sir. Then report back in, you'll get your assignment. I said, all right, I'll be back in tomorrow morning. Went back the next day, and I worked overnight. I got home. It's usually about an hour and a half drive home for me from there, back to Schmokin. And as I was going upstairs, my wife answered the phone and said, hey, it's for you. And it was, I don't know if I'm allowed to name a name or not, but it was the psychiatrist from the institution. And I won't mention his name. I have no ill feelings towards him. There was so many new things that came about because of this incident that they just didn't know how to handle everything. And he told me that he didn't want me going back till he saw me. I said, well, you know, I'm okay. I said, I need to get back to work. He said, no, you're too anxious. He gave me, I think it was 30 days off or something like that.
Oh, wow.
So I called back in, and I told at that time, I can't remember which captain took it, but I explained to him what had happened, and said, okay, I'll mark you off and let us know. So came close to my time of being to go back to work, and called down and made an appointment. My appointment to see the psychiatrist was at the administration building of SCI Camp Hill, and my appointment was at 10 in the morning. And I got there a little bit early, and I waited. And I didn't have breakfast. I drove all the way down, and lunchtime came, and I called in, and a friend of mine at the nurse, Joni Campbell, answered, and she says, he's still down at the hall. He's talking to inmates yet. All right. I said, okay, well, let me know, Joni. And I waited another hour and a half. Now it was like close to almost 3 o'clock. And called back in and talked to Joni. And she said, Ernie's still not back. I said, well, you know, I've been here all day. I haven't eaten yet. And I said, just with the rush hour traffic, I said, I'm going to go back. Just tell them I'll call and reschedule. So I called in to reschedule, and he told me now I was too impatient because I wouldn't wait for him, and he gave me another 30 days.
Oh, my goodness.
It was absurd, and it was hurting me psychologically to be off. I needed to like, get back on the horse. I needed to get back in and know I could do this. And made a phone call to find out what openings were available elsewhere, and a records position was open in Frackville. I went there, stayed in records. I was only supposed to be in a little bit less than a year until they had an opening for an officer, but the records supervisor ended up falling and had to have major surgery, and so they allowed me an extension without penalizing me, and I stayed on for a little bit longer, and then I went back in uniform and retook the test, got my stripes back on, and then eventually made lieutenant.
Phew.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So, wow. Did you ever then have a real debriefing after that?
We had, there was one attempt at a group debriefing and it didn't go very well with several of the officers that were even involved, more so than I, with the riot, because the person that came in, the psychologist or whatever his title was, at some point said, well, you have to look at it from the inmate's point of view, and two of the officers lunged over the table at him.
That one was Jerry Kostelak.
Jerry is godparent for my oldest daughter.
Oh, I interviewed Jerry, and he told me that story.
Yes, we were, okay, I'm glad you said that, because I wasn't going to say that, but yes. Yeah, Jerry is a godfather for my oldest, or wait, no, my youngest daughter, his wife is godmother for my oldest.
Wow.
That's how it is.
He did say that the debriefing was pretty much useless when...
Yeah. And then they sent me, during that time I was off, they sent me down to a place called Psychological Services in Sunbury, about 20 minutes from my house. And, I mean, do I think it helped? I don't know. I'm not putting anyone at fault for anything, but I don't think it was the kind of talking or therapy I needed, if that makes sense. It just didn't, I mean, I was grateful for it, but it wasn't exactly what I had needed at all. And, I mean, to this day, I go to a restaurant and I sit with my back to the wall. I mean, I do have, I'm not going to say, they told me I have PTSD from it, but I'm not like anything violent. I'm not saying that just to say, well, I have that. Certain things make me remember things. Like I said, I might forget a few of the names, but I remember every order and every step I took that day.
Right. I just have to say that I did interview Tab Bickle, and he told me about his situation, and I said, so when did you go back to work? And he's like, I went back that night, and he was there the next day. And I just find it interesting how he was trapped in the switch boxes with the inmates trying to electrocute him, and and the psychologist didn't stop him from going back to work.
No, I don't know. I don't know. Now, I will say this for the interview part. I have no proof of this. This is only hearsay and rumor that was going around, that by keeping us off, and this psychiatrist was charging the state for interviews.
Oh.
So if we would call in and talk to him about going back to work, he would consider that an interview, ask us a few questions, and then charge the state. So, but again, I don't know. Like I said, I went back that night. They told me to take a day off because my lower back and all that kind of stuff. So I called right away. I needed to go back in. I couldn't let the inmates think they won. You know what I mean? That was my mentality at the time.
So let's talk about some of the sights and sounds. Afterwards, you said, like, for the second day, you were outside the perimeter. Where outside the perimeter would you have been situated?
Right outside the, in between the main gate and the, at that time, the department building.
Oh, okay.
Is that the North Tower? Or the Highway Tower, that's there.
Right, yes.
Which one?
So, do you remember seeing the police special teams go in and rescue a hostage?
I remember teams going in. At the when they made their final assault, I did not see anything that I could recognize as like a special team going in, you know what I mean, as in, oh, we found out one guy's located, we're going in after him. I didn't see anything like that I realized what was going on. I more or less saw the final push when they entered and shots were fired. And then the inmates took cover. They ran back in the cell blocks and off. When they pushed through the gatehouse, they had the double gates down there all barricaded. There's many fires going on in the compound. The helicopter was above with spotlight going, giving orders. There's another bullhorn going on from someone shouting out orders, that kind of stuff. It was like surreal that I was even there. It was just like something out of a movie.
Mm-hmm. I know I was there in central office watching from my office, had a perfect view over the area that the six housing units were. And the sound of the helicopters, that kind of triggered me for a while after that. The sound of the humming portable generator lights that were lighting up the perimeter. Did you feel the same way about helicopters? And
yeah, especially because being here in Shamokin, right outside, we have, well, now Geising, it used to be Shamokin State General Hospital. Geising, it's a good over, but there's a helipad there. So the helipad that's in Minersville, they have one there for Schuylkill County, and they, if they transport to Shamokin or Danville, they cross right over Shamokin every time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, even in this day, if I'm not ready for it, might catch me off guard.
Right.
I also notice I'm very much more observant of people walking into a room if I'm at a restaurant or if I'm out with friends or something like that. I'm constantly watching body movements and what people are doing with their hands or, you know, that kind of stuff. It's a constant. It doesn't turn off.
Wow. Even 30 years later.
30 years later, it doesn't. And I'm no fighter. I'm no military guy or anything like that. It just doesn't turn off.
Yeah. How old were you at the time?
89, 62, what is that? 26. Yeah, it wasn't my birthday. I was 26.
Okay.
I was only a sergeant for a hot 8 months.
So tell me what some of the things were that led to it. Like, what were the causes? What were the causes?
I could tell you a little bit of a story. I still have the paperwork somewhere. If I dig for it, I have a box buried away in my attic somewhere. About 7 weeks, 8 weeks before the riot, I actually, because of this, I had to testify down in Harrisburg because of this.
Oh.
We were running, got quiet out here. I'm going to step out here. There's one more air out. So we, were running showers on E block, and up on tier 4, third cell back, I had the known secretary of the FOI, Fruits of Islam.
Okay.
And I saw inmates like they do running showers. I saw an inmate stop by and all. And I was a sergeant. I would go down and relieve my guy, use the restroom, get a coffee or something. But I kept watching from down. It was unusual because not only did black inmates stop there, but several white inmates stopped to talk to him. And he had a legal pad. And he was jotting down some stuff and all. So I watched, and a few more people stopped. And as we're closing in, showers, I called down to my lieutenant, Jimmy Reinecker, and asked him if I could do a cell search. I told him what I saw. So he authorized one. So he sent me a couple extra guys for after showers. And then as my officer did count, I came up the tier behind him, about two cells behind him, with two extra officers. And we got to the door, waved the arm, and opened. And the first thing this inmate did was take the tablet and throw it in a box and kick the box underneath the bed. So that was the first thing, of course, we went for. He was running his mouth about things and all. But on the list of his title, what must be done, and there was a listing of different things going on there. Had to deal with, if I recall it correctly, like family days and visitations and the overcrowding and some other things that were on there. So I did that report, turned it in, made copies of everything, and the reason I had to go down and testify was, I guess, the deputy Smith at the time didn't take action on anything, or they didn't feel it was correctly investigated, and I had to go down in front of Senator Greenleaf and the others to testify against about these papers, to explain how I came about finding them and all. Mm. So
that sounded like a list of demands.
It was. I found out afterwards that I was actually on some kind of list that the inmates had because of that. But thank God I made it out.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot. I know there's changes that go about. I understand that. Even at that time, being a young sergeant, I understood it. But the other thing I also understood, there's too many changes too swiftly, in my opinion. They came about with changes for the visiting and the family, then the family day. Then they made changes in education and some other programs. I can't recall exactly which ones, but I just remember it just seemed like every week we'd get, another handful of memos of different changes that were going on. We had to post them and all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, these guys get into a set routine, and they don't take the change well, especially when it's one after the other. You know what I mean? But in my opinion, that was one of the things. Everything contributed to it with the visiting thing and everything else you heard, but it was also the speed at which everything was being changed.
Mm-hmm.
There was no leeway, no breathing room in between to let things adjust.
Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to ask you to, at about the same time, talk to me about staff morale, because everybody that I talked to says it was really bad. Morale was really bad among staff. Talk about that.
When you talk about morale, it's the staff themselves were tight-knit. We were brothers and sisters working a job together, had each other's back and all that. A lot of the morale problems came, again, I feel, this is my opinion, because of the amount of changes that were going on. Everyone saw that. Everyone heard the bickering. Everyone heard the shouting on the cell block about what's going on. That ain't effing cool, and blah, blah, blah. This and that and all, and we could feel it building. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't morale with each other, it was morale because of, when I say administration, I'm not saying the entire administration, because John Stover, the major,
mm-hmm.
I would walk through hell with him,
mm-hmm.
or for him. He wouldn't have to go on, I'd go through for him. he was, and I felt that way about a lot of my uniform staff, and not putting down anything. I got along with many of the staff, but the speed of how fast these changes came about and not listening to the staff, it was falling on deaf ears. And I truly, you know, to this day, in my opinion, again, that's just how I feel.
Mm-hmm, sure. Tell me a little bit about the inmates on E block, because I hear, was that where the parole violators mostly were, and that parole violators were just kind of sitting around and were kind of part of the problem too?
Yeah, there were, you know, there was, you know, changes going on. Parole violators got in there. They'd be waiting for, you know, they get in, they would come back and they would have to put toll. Now, you know, you violated, we want you to take this program either again or take a new program or something. And although there is a variety of programs, because of the overcrowded situation as a whole in the jail, the getting these inmates in, there was some lengthy waiting lists to get in there. You know, some of them went, from what I understood, several months long.
Wow.
Yeah,
into
the program.
Right. That's a long time for them to be sitting around, and I'm sure they were aware of all the grumbling and just kind of joined in. Did you go back to Camp Hill for the 25th anniversary, I guess, of the riot?
No, I did not know that they were having anything. However, someone, I saw a shirt that they had advertised and they were selling, and I reached out and asked how I could get one, and I forget who it was. Someone sent me a shirt, and I sent them a money order to pay for it. I forget who it was, but so I had my anniversary shirt.
I know that they don't have a complete listing of individuals who were there at the time, so maybe through all of my interviews I can help them build that list back up. So I know that after you left Camp Hill, you said in 1990, and went to Frackville, and went there, was there for 20 years. Did you ever go back inside Camp Hill then? Like, have you seen it since it's been rebuilt?
No, never. I did one transport after hours. We had an inmate on staff assault at Frackville, and I ended up doing a transport after hours down to Camp Hill. We went back to the rear gate to be processed in, and I looked up and I heard ski. That's all I heard. And I looked up and it was Nate Hargrove, my officer from on E block.
Uh-huh.
So,
would you ever go back inside?
Absolutely.
Would you? Okay.
I would absolutely go back inside just to. I think it would give me closure to say, you know what, one of my friends I hear recording it, you know what, motherfuckers, I'm back. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Not a problem. All right, so I guess my last question for you would be, what kind of advice would you give to current DOC employees, whether officers or not, if they find themselves in a situation, what should they do?
If they are in a riot situation?
Sure.
Well, I know they say about cooperating and everything else like that, but if it's at the onset of a riot, fight like you're the third monkey getting onto Noah's Ark.
I don't mean to laugh at that, but that was funny. But I understand. Somebody else, and I'm not sure whether it was Chip Rice or whether...
I know Chip real well.
I interviewed him too. So I don't know whether it was him or whether it was Jerry. I think it was Jerry said, what you should do is run like hell. If you can't run, you should hide. But always try to get out.
Yeah, always try to get out. The whole thing... if there's a way, if it's at the onset of an incident, get out. If you can grab a fellow staff member and help him or her get out, do the same thing. But fight like you're the third monkey trying to get on Noah's Ark. That's my advice.
Is there anything else that you remember that you wanted to share that we might have missed?
Always keep your eyes open. Even the smallest thing might mean something. Keep notes and watch these other six. That's all I can say. And God forbid you have to go through something like we did back then. Just do what you can to get out. We'll sort everything else out later.
Great.
That was a piece of advice I had from, at that time, Captain Prackville. My first time on the desk as a lieutenant, he was going out the night yard. He said, "That phone goes off. You do something. It might not be the right thing, but we'll sort it out later. But do something." I'll never forget that.
Great. Bernie, I want to thank you for participating in this, and I really appreciate it.